You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is now 7:59. Stay tuned for the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show and look at the bank bailout plan and how nice it is to be rich while that plan goes down.
For the first time in the 7 years that it's been open, there is a definitive Guantanamo prisoner list. Join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, on KBOO's Political Perspectives, and my guest, Andy Worthington, journalist, author, and human rights activist. We'll talk about his just-released list of Guantanamo prisoners. Where have the released prisoners gone? Who's still locked up, and under what conditions? Tune in Tuesday morning, March 24th at 9 a.m. on KBOO's Political Perspectives.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Tar Sands Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent with author Andrew Nikiforuk. Proceeds will benefit KBOO Community Radio. This presentation will explore the dangers and destructiveness of tar sand oil production, a signature of peak oil. The event is sponsored by Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. That's Tar Sands with author Andrew Nikiforuk, Tuesday, March 31st from 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. More information is available by phone 503-232-5495.
Good morning, good morning. Oh, salvation has come. Be joyous unto the skies. For the Obama administration has come up with a plan that will be tolerable to the vicious Republicans who I sincerely believe at this point in their leadership would rather see the nation's entire economy crash than to allow the possibility of a Democratic Congress and a Democratic presidency having success. But the stock market responded to the promises of the toxic purchasing of bad mortgages in such a manner as to excite the hearts and minds of investors everywhere. 500 points. Woo-wee! And everybody's very happy. Hello, this is Joe Uris. Next to me. Okay, almost.
Dude,
next
I literally just got here.
Hi.
I had a bicycle tire blow out.
Well, that's bicycles.
That's never happened.
Bicycles are useless. Everyone
knows. No.
Two wheels doesn't make sense.
I've had tubes get holes in them, but the whole tire literally blew out. I watched it happen. I nearly wrecked.
Maybe you were being shot at.
I doubt it.
Maybe you've gained. Maybe you're so important now that you've gained serious enemies.
No, I think I set a bad tire.
All right, if you're just tuning in, this is KBOO, 90.7 your FM dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. The number to call, 231-8187, the banking crisis. And I wanted to talk a little bit first about the emerging of resources for Fox News and NBC.
I want to hear why you think bicycles are useless.
Well, I'm not going to defend that. That was just a throwaway silliness.
Just hyperbole?
Hyperbole, yes.
Joe, people are going to stop taking you seriously, man.
I don't care. You're here for that. I'm just here to have fun. Anyway, well, I better take this seriously. In order to save money, NBC and Fox News are going to merge their production facilities. They're going to send out pool reporters, presumably, but definitely pool photographers to take pictures of events in local markets and then bring them back, and then presumably each of the separate companies will edit the copy and add some voice overhead.
Oh, I see. This is what passes for journalism now.
This is what passes for journalism now. And it's going to be a disaster. I mean, Fox News is this right-wing craziness. NBC is this center right-wing craziness. So they're pretty far away from each other.
GE-owned center right-wing.
Yeah, GE and Fox owned by the crazy Australian.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's something that's already done deal. They tried it out in Philadelphia and a couple other markets, and they like it. And it's probably going to happen. So there's that. Then even more fun than that is the fact that the Oregonian has announced it's going to further reduce its staff. And it's already cut enormous number of pages. And in general, if you out there want to be informed, this station becomes even more important, number one. Number two, there are so many good publications, ranging from The Nation to what's good?
I don't know. You're just
Mother
talking
Jones,
about how many of
Mother
them.
Mother Jones, all them things out there you can subscribe to. You got lots of online sources of news. So you shouldn't be too despairing. But what we really want to concentrate on today.
Now, wait a minute.
What?
You just talked about the demise of print journalism.
Yeah.
In terms of daily newspapers.
Yeah.
And then you cited as alternatives this radio station, which was good.
Yeah.
And you cited The Nation and Mother Jones, which were also good. But there's also an entire world.
Blogosphere.
Yeah, well, not just the blogosphere, but actual, serious journalism going on the internet.
Huffington Post.
See, but this all went right by you. See,
no, it didn't go by me. It didn't go by me.
You didn't even list it as an alternative to daily print journalism.
I just consider it all something that people have to spend time on.
Well, yeah, but I don't understand that.
I have a vicious, negative attitude toward anything that isn't made with ink.
Wow.
No, I do. I am a reactionary old guy, and I believe in the crinkliness.
Yeah, sure. Okay, but
crinkliness is sacred. Anything less than crinkiness is obviously electronic. It involves tubes.
Yeah, it does involve tubes.
There's tubes
like the kind of hamsters run through.
Yeah,
But see,
it's pneumatic tubes like Paris used to have in department stores, even in Oregon used to have.
If you listen carefully, listeners, you can hear the sound of a decaying metaphor right now. But, okay, there's, for example, talkingpointsmemo.com, one of my favorite blogs.
It's a good blog.
Multiple times a day, yes. They are doing...
You go there multiple times a day, I rest my case. What a waste of your energy.
They have turned it not just into a place for people to comment on what's going on, but an actual news shop that's producing top-notch work. For example... it was TalkingPointsMemo.com, not a newspaper, not a magazine, that broke the U.S. attorney firing scandal year before last.
That's true.
They broke it.
You know, that's true.
Yes, it is.
You know, are you going to just kind of prove that I'm wrong? Is that your goal?
Yeah, exactly.
Is that it?
Yes.
That's the limits of your concern?
Well, that is prominent every Tuesday. I like to prove you wrong whenever I can. But that's not the limits of my concern, no. What I'm saying is, yes, it's a bad time for print journalism right now. The number and quality of good dailies is declining all the time. But there's an alternative out there.
Yeah, sloppy stuff, too.
Yeah, there's awful sloppy stuff there. It requires people nowadays need to be discerning readers of news.
Readers,
they have to exercise good judgment. They have
judgment?
To have an appropriate grasp of the arc of history in order to evaluate the
arc
context.
Arc of history?
Yes, evaluate the
Listen
context.
To you.
Of, do you ever let me say anything without interjecting? That's another thing that's been bothering me. There is good journalism out there, but the times demand that people have a discerning eye, a good grasp of history, the ability to evaluate context, and listening to this station will help you with all of those things.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. We're going to talk seriously, though, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
We're going to talk seriously about the economic recovery plan, such as it is.
Yes, such as it is.
Such as it is. And you are very critical because you've been reading Krugman in the print journal.
Yes, yes, I have been reading Krugman in the print, in the online version print journalism.
Yeah. We got lots of callers already.
Yes, we do. Well, let's take some of those.
Well, why? Okay.
Okay, who we got?
You got me.
LJ, what's up?
LJ, okay, I haven't heard from you in a while.
I'm going to be short, sweet, and to the point, you guys.
All right. I believe it when I hear it, LJ.
Go ahead. Okay, here you go. The Swiss bank, UBS, was fined $700 million by the USA for secret bank accounts for 50,000 Americans to avoid paying their federal taxes. Right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, UBS got money from the American taxpayer, some billions of dollars in this for the bailout, because for some reason the Swiss bankers are deserving of our tax dollars. And the Swiss bank, UBS, paid their fine with the American taxpayer dollar. Ha, ha, ha.
Thank you for that, LJ.
You're welcome. Anytime. Have a great day.
Yeah, that really it reminds me of how corrupt our system is. Here's how corrupt our system is. It is so corrupt that it is not capitalism anymore. It is late-stage capitalism, in which essentially there is socialism for the rich, and go to hell list for everybody else.
Yeah, and that's really embodied in this bank bailout plan that came out today.
What is your against it? And look, the stock market went up nearly 500 points. Wonderful.
You know, actually, you know, people have been there's been some debate right now as to whether the performance of the stock market is a good indicator of the state of the economy. I think it is, but not in the way that most people are saying. I say if the stock market goes up in response to a decision made by the Obama administration, that probably means the decision is wrong. The stock market goes up because the investor class is happy at whatever news has just been released or whatever action has just been taken.
You know, I want to insert something here that's very important that maybe people don't understand and that I tend to forget. I'm very critical of the Obama response to all of this. I think I agree with Krugman that it's too little too late and we need a more Rooseveltian approach to the problems, including nationalization of banks. But the reality is, the harsh reality is that the Democrats do not control Congress. That's number one. They really don't because you need 60% to be able to end the filibuster danger.
Oh, that's a mythical danger. Well, we can get to that.
Well, we can get to that, but the alleged danger. That's number one. Number two, people haven't been scared enough. By the time Franklin Delano Roosevelt assumed the presidency in 1933, remember, 1933, so it's 32 that he gets elected, 33 he actually assumes the presidency. By the time that happened, so many people were out of work. So many people had lost their homes. So many people were actually living in Hoovervilles that people were demanding the kinds of reforms. Moreover, there was a very strong left wing in American politics at that time. And a populist movement that was largely left-wing. None of that exists today. If you want to be honest, the left in America argues over issues that I consider, while important to the people involved, fundamentally inane to the economic issues of our age. Right now, I'm looking in Portland, Oregon. Oh, people are going to get mad at me at this. I'm looking in Portland, Oregon. What's the dominant issue locally from the perspective of minorities right now?
Cesar Chavez.
Cesar Chavez Boulevard. And does that do anything actually for the economy?
No.
In fact,
well,
negatively.
It would employ some people who change street signs.
They're already employed.
And relabel the maps. Yeah, you're right. They're already employed.
And this is a big thing. This is a sense of pride. This is important. I understand all that. But fundamentally, I think a lot of people, after years and years of being repressed, systematically in the McCarthy era and other times, after years and years of labor being smashed through legislation that reversed the Wagner Act and a lot of other legislation that was created during the Great Depression, fundamentally, there is so little popular left that there isn't an opportunity to build up the momentum that was present in 1932. And that's an important thing that you and I certainly, I don't want to blame you, seem, and a lot of our listeners, I think, seem not to realize. Furthermore, people are totally entertained to death and lied to all the time. And the ideology of Ayn Rand capitalism has come to permeate every aspect of the society in a way that was not the case in the 1930s. So we are really in a situation where, even though the obvious facts are there, even though we see monopoly capital at operation, even though we know the sleaziness of the banking system, even though we are deeply aware of the toxicity and horror of the Bush administration, even though all of that is out there for everyone to see, people are confused, people are ideologically twisted, and it's very difficult, therefore, for somebody like Barack Obama, who comes in the middle of all this, to figure out how the hell he and his administration can maintain popularity and at the same time make the necessary changes. Now, that does not excuse them from doing some of the things they've done. I just want to point that out, though.
Well, I both agree and don't agree. I think that there is a pretty sizable left in this country. I think there's a pretty sizable populist movement that is very firmly in support of this president. The problem is the major political party that nominally represents the left has become ashamed over the last three decades of being called liberal. The Democrats.
You're talking about the Democrats?
I'm talking about the Democrats. Yes. So I think the problem is that the progressive left, which I think is pretty pervasive, by and large, in this country, is not represented in the halls of Congress or in state houses around the country.
Well,
that's the problem.
Yeah, and of course, when you have somebody who wants a national health insurance, they're not even invited to the table.
even if they're Congress people, unless a big stink is made.
Sure. So the problem that manifests itself then, as I was just explaining, is that this large-scale progressive movement doesn't have representation in the halls of Congress, and therefore we don't see progressive priorities enacted into law. Further, we see a spineless center-left corporate Democratic Party continually beaten back by a Republican Party that very effectively brandishes fear as a weapon. And we saw that all through the Bush administration. There was really no opposition to speak of. And this, as we can quite plainly see, is a huge, huge problem. And it indicates just how deep and pervasive the influence of the financial sector is on the political process. When President Obama, who, as president of the Republic, effectively represents an 80% stake in the EIG, for example, but can't even force its executives to give their bonuses back. He's unable or unwilling politically or ideologically or whatever to exercise that 80% stake and actually lead by example here.
Well, I think that the issue of the bonuses is a diversion, actually.
But it is and it isn't. It is a diversion.
It's symbolic.
It is symbolic. And really the amount of money is chump change compared to the total cost of this bailout. But it goes to show how powerful these guys are, how deeply their claws are stuck into our system, and how really impotent the president is to do anything about it. Now, I tend to think that if he really wanted to and decided to do something about it, he could, and there'd be very little that these guys could do to stop him, especially considering the government owns an equity share in companies like AIG and a whole bunch of other major banking outfits at this point. All we really need to do is exercise our rights of ownership, and we could solve this problem.
So,
but the administration, for whatever reason, appears to be unwilling to do this, unwilling to publicly embrace the term nationalization, which the Republicans have utilized to beat Obama about the head with.
Well, they call it socialism.
They do call it socialism.
They would call it communism.
And he backs off from that. He backs off instead of simply refuting that, which he could do easily, and taking the steps to nationalize these big banks, the ones that are deemed too big to fail. He could just do that, and these problems would be on their way to being solved. But he's unable or unwilling to do it.
I agree with you.
And the clock is ticking, as Krugman points out.
Well, and in fact, the momentum that Obama brings to the White House can easily be squandered under these circumstances. He could lose even more control in the 1-0 election.
Yes, he could.
The 2010.
Yeah. So I think he needs to appreciate the depth and breadth of the populist rage that exists right now in this country. And it's there, believe me.
Well, he needs to get in front of it and lead it.
Yes, yes, and use it to his and everyone's advantage. I can understand why he's intimidated, because it means breaking the back of the financial establishment. The masters of the universe that have played fast and loose with the rules need to be disenfranchised. And so far, they're still in charge of the companies that they ran into the ground.
But you're assuming that he wants or might want to do that. I don't think that's his ideology. I've said from the very get-go here that I admire the man's intellect. I admire his cleverness politically. I think it's really cool we have our first African-American president, blah, blah, blah. But the fact of the matter is that he's a centrist in an economic and political climate where everything has been driven to the right. So what is called liberal or left today is really what Nelson Rockefeller was when he was an active politician. And what is called the right today is really quite fascist.
Really quite crazy.
Well, crazy, yeah. Even beyond fascism.
Yeah, and that illustrates just how far the frame of debate has been shifted to the
right.
In this country.
My
over
point.
Years. Yeah, but I think Obama's more progressive than he gave him credit for, and I hope that he's listening to the right sorts of people, which don't include his Treasury Secretary or his Fed Chairman.
Well, right. He didn't have to choose those schmucks.
No, he did not have to choose those schmucks. Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, financial wunderkind by all accounts, really smart guy, really bright guy, but deeply connected to the same Wall Street masters of the universe culture that got us into this mess. Geithner, yesterday, unveiled a plan that is really, this is the third time now that the original Hank Paulson Bush era plan to bail out the banks has been redressed and rolled out again. Basically, it involves the government stepping in and buying all of these mortgage derivatives that have come to be known as toxic assets that the banks have on these books. He proposes that the government come in and buy them up at a value that far exceeds what the market is actually willing to pay for them. And further, he wants to subsidize private sector investors to buy these things, and he wants to guarantee their investment against substantial losses in the future. In other words, he's going to step in and use the taxpayers to buy this garbage up at a vastly inflated price and then use taxpayers as a backstop for these guys if they are to eventually lose money on these investments.
Well, and in fact, if you really believe in a market, these toxic assets should be marked to market. That is, their value is not what that was 3 years ago. It's what it is today, and that ain't much.
No. And this is really ironic, given that these people, the masters of the universe, are so devoted to the supposed infallibility of the free market and its ability to accurately value assets.
No, they only believe in the free market for you and me, not for them.
No, exactly. They're
socialists for them.
Right, right. They deserve their bonuses, even though the taxpayers are paying them.
And given that they
because
go ahead.
We're investment bankers, and we got into this business for bonuses.
What has to happen, and what may yet happen, is banking has to go back to the regulations that were instilled in the Roosevelt era. That is, the banks need to be pared away from the investment aspect, the stock market aspect, all of those kinds of services that standard banks are now offering. Banks need to be back to the role they played after the reforms that were so necessary in the Great Depression. All of that has been rolled back consistently.
Yes.
The worst of the rollbacks, I think, were during the Reagan administration. But there were plenty of them in the last 8 years. And I have to
in
say,
the Clinton administration.
I have to say the Clinton administration. And it's the Clinton administration economic people who dominate the table for Barack Obama.
Yeah, Larry Summers. Another financial wunderkind, with a former president of Harvard who was fired for making sexist remarks.
I remember that.
Yeah, he has went on a couple Sunday news shows this weekend and essentially dodged these very important questions, like who's accountable for this money? Why are the taxpayers being asked to socialize any potential losses made by these investors? Why are the taxpayers being asked to pay for assets that are worthless? And he dodged all those questions.
Well,
and this is a guy who has the ear of the president.
I think that it would be fine if the government took over the toxic assets as long as they took over the banks and controlled their behavior.
Right. See, but that would be socialism. And I just
that would be sensible.
Exactly. And I just threw out that would be socialism line as an aside, but that's the argument that's being... I know, but I'm making a point here. This is the argument that's being leveled right now, and this is the argument, seemingly, that Obama is buying because he's unable to take that step and bring these banks into receivership. Again, ironic, because it's happening with small and regional banks every single day. The FDIC has taken over more banks all the time. And if you want a good accounting of that, you can check out the blogger Atrios at eschatonblog.com.
Whenever you hear the words public-private investment, hold on to your wallet.
And run away.
Run fast away. And that, of course, brings us, we're not going there, to our soccer disaster. Okay, let's just give some folks out there an opportunity. 231-8187.
We're also taking emails, joeandabe@yahoo.com. Elizabeth, good morning.
Good morning. I thought you two would never quit.
Oh, well.
Elizabeth, do you call us up to tell us that we never quit?
Only in our dreams do we never quit.
I'm interested in print. That's where I was when I got on the phone. I'm interested in whether or not in 200 years or 1,000 years there's going to be a record of anything if there's no print.
It'll be in the tubes.
Tubes.
You mean a journalistic record?
We still have print from 1,000 years ago?
Oh, yeah, we do.
Is there going to be print?
Wait. 1,000 years ago, we didn't really, strictly speaking, have...
We had papyrus, no?
Well, we have written records.
We have
of
written records.
From 1,000
years ago.
That's
what you're talking about, right?
Okay.
Written records.
And you're telling me we're going to have written records of what's in computers?
No. But the print journalism hasn't gone away. It's just in decline, and there are official records that are taken of activities in Congress, for example. I mean, we'll still have a record of this time.
Because civilization will have crumbled, and we'll go the way of the dinosaurs, and new creatures, probably cockroaches, will say, you know, I don't believe in any theory of evolution.
I'm with the cockroaches, for sure. But I don't think that burning the books is nearly as effective as just doing away with print.
Well, I think you have a good point. I'm not sure that that's an immediate danger. I think, as I said earlier, there is both in hard copy and, as Abe points out, online, a lot of information, and it stays there for a long, long time. One of the things the Rolling Stones pointed out was, you know, yesterday's newspaper is, for most people, something you put the bad fish innards in.
So what? There's still plenty of it.
Well, there is still plenty of it, and I would point out that one of the most important aspects of retaining this kind of information is keeping the libraries functional. For example, the Oregon Historical Society Library, which almost shut down and will shut down for lack of funding, and there was a little ruckus raised around that, is a key factor in scholarly research and public interest in the facts of Oregon history. That's something that has to be preserved. Similarly, public libraries keep deacquisitioning, throwing away all kinds of books, good ones and bad ones, based on how often they're checked out and how they've deteriorated. And on top of that, there is a pattern of using old technologies, for example, microfiche or microfilm in reels for preserving old newspapers, and that becomes extremely difficult. It's also the case that the libraries, which some people call the morgue, at newspapers are less and less accessible, even to the reporters at those newspapers. So there are some, I mean, you're raising some real issues about the preservation of knowledge that have been dogging people for some time now.
I don't think our civilization really cares about knowledge. And I don't think that just because I do, I'm going to create enough like-minded people in my lifetime that it's going to make a difference. Nevertheless, the question of knowledge is at the heart of this.
Well,
as a Republican, I really don't think my party cares about knowledge.
I would agree with that. Yeah, in fact, they seem to run screaming from knowledge, especially when it opposes their agenda.
Well, I think one of the funny factors of our culture is that we have an enormous availability of information and entertainment. And most people, given their circumstances, are looking for the escape of entertainment rather than the dreary actuality of knowledge. And that is a decision that is driven by advertisers, by opportunists looking for large markets, by a whole host of forces, including people's, I have to say this, people's desire to be entertained rather than confronted with the grim realities of life.
I can't get the image of the, I think they called them circuses. We're talking about huge amphitheaters mm-hmm. with the brutal contests down on the...
Gladiators.
Yeah. And the lions and what
right.
have you.
Uh-huh.
Well, we have a little of that.
Well, that looks to me like what we have. Yes, it's decentralized, and yes.
Well, no, you can go to a cage fight. I think at one of the casinos here, the Native Americans' Revenge.
I thought that was tobacco. Anyway. Are you still there?
I'm here. I think that's what we have. I think what we have is a decentralized electronic version of gladiators.
Oh, no, I don't agree with you. Abe and I have this mock fight over the Internet. The fact of the matter is that there is an enormous amount, more information than ever before out there because of the Internet. And with my slow computer and so on, can access it and do access it. And I know more about what's going on now than I did probably 30 years ago, let's say, 20 years ago.
And you attribute that to access as opposed to a cumulative structure in your mind, which shows you where to put the information.
Well, I mean,
to knowledge.
That's an impossible question to answer. I am who I am, and Abe is who he is, and you are who you are. I'm not going to make an evaluation of how our minds process information. But listen, I want folks to get a chance to get back to this toxic assets issue. Not that I don't think your conversation is important.
The only reason that we're ever going to sort out the toxic assets issue is if we have enough paper. It's never going to be sorted out electronically. I'm a contracting officer. It takes paper.
Okay. Hey, listen, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it.
She has a point.
Yeah, she does have a point.
Besides which, you cannot burn your computer for heat.
Well, you could try.
That'd be toxic. Really toxic.
Yeah, you could burn all these bad mortgages for heat. Maybe that's the answer.
Hey, there you go.
Engineer Steve.
Engineer Steve!
Who is always on hand to inject a little sunshine into our dreary conversation, hands us a note reading, once we don't have enough energy to power the computer infrastructure, all data will evaporate. Thank you, Steve.
Why did you read that? I mean, he's just off right on his tooth.
I'm going to read from Krugman's column yesterday.
Okay. And then we'll go to you out there. Be patient.
Yep. Tim Geithner, this is Krugman writing in the Times yesterday. You can read it electronically.
Tim Geithner is short, you know.
I didn't know that.
It's a very important fact.
Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, has persuaded President Obama to recycle Bush administration policy, specifically the cash for trash plan proposed, then abandoned 6 months ago by then Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson.
Wait, stop for a moment. I just want to remind everybody that Henry Paulson's son is going to do the thing to us here in Portland, Oregon, with his soccer/baseball game.
Okay. Krugman continues, this is more than disappointing. In fact, it fills me with a sense of despair. It's as if the president were determined to confirm the growing perception that he and his economic team are out of touch, that their economic vision is clouded by excessively close ties to Wall Street. And by the time Mr. Obama realizes that he needs to change course, his political capital may be gone.
That was what I was saying earlier.
Exactly, and I think that goes to the heart of it. Obama right now is the beneficiary of an enormous public reservoir of goodwill. Now, if he's seen to be capitulating to these masters of the universe who ran the global economy into the ground, then he will squander that, and things will go badly for the vast majority of Americans.
Well, and when you couple that with the fact that, as I said earlier, and I've said several times now on the air, the Republicans would rather see the nation collapse than lose power.
Indeed. Here's from the New York Times yesterday. Some executives of private equity firms and hedge funds were briefed on Geithner's plan Sunday afternoon are anxious about the recent uproar over millions of dollars in bonus payments made to the executives of the American International Group, AIG. Some of them have told administrative officials that they would participate only if the government guaranteed that it would not set compensation limits on the firms, according to people briefed on the conversations. The executives also expressed worries about whether disclosure and governance rules could be added retroactively to the program by Congress. These people said. So let's just dig into this a little bit. Here is an entire industry who, by extension, has ruined the global economy. These people were spectacularly inept at doing what it is they're supposed to be so brilliant at. And now they're saying they won't even let the government step in and save their bacon unless the government agrees to abandon all limits on their compensation. So they're literally wanting to have their cake and eat it too, even though they've failed at a grandiose level.
They really, they don't get it. And the reason why they don't get it is they're not scared. And the reason they're not scared is they know that nobody's going to hurt them.
Yeah, nobody's going to hurt them. Obama owns 80% of AIG, but he's unable to tell these guys they can't have their bonuses.
Well,
why should these guys be scared at all? Why can't they just assume they can go on ruling the world as they have for the past several decades with no accountability to anyone?
The Toxic Assets Program, I'm not sure all of our listeners understand it. There's a public-private investment program. The umbrella organization will support the effort to entice private investors, that's not you or I, let me tell you, to join with the government to purchase troubled assets. The administration plans to commit $75 to $100 billion. Now, that is inflationary, and that's the one thing the Republicans are right about when they warn about these things. They're going to dump this money onto these toxic assets, and the purchases will initially expand to $1 trillion over time. $1 trillion. That's a lot of zeros, more than I can remember.
That's a million. A
is it really?
A trillion is a million stacks of $1 million.
Can I have one?
Sure.
Oh, cool.
Sure.
I'll buy that. Troubled mortgage loans, the FDIC, which is one of the few solvent, reasonable agencies that protects your and my investments in banks. The money we put in, up to $250,000, is safe because it's backed by the government FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Now, the FDIC is being called upon, I can't believe this, to provide the financing to the winning bidders for these toxic assets. And then the bidders have nothing to worry about. Essentially, they're 86% of the purchase price will be covered by the FDIC. The Treasury bailout fund contributes 7%, and the winning private investor contributes just 7%. And if it goes wrong,
they're insulated.
They're insulated.
Yes.
This is what they've come up with.
The government is subsidizing private investors to buy assets that are worth nothing.
Well, and worth then, less than they're going to be purchased for. I don't
right.
know. Nothing.
Well, virtually nothing.
Okay.
And then insured if it all goes bad. If that's not privilege at work, I don't know what it is.
Well, I don't care about the privilege aspect, actually. What I care
I
about...
I think the privilege aspect is the heart of what's going on.
Well, I think...
People feel entitled to rule the world. How dare Obama and the rabble tell them they can't do otherwise?
I understand your point, but I think the structural issues involved are very real as well. I think that we are... Because we're throwing money at the problem without gaining control of the assets and the banks and so on, we are in moving toward a time when we could find ourselves having hyperinflation because money's just being printed. Just being printed. And that's an extremely dangerous situation. You print the money, and it makes sense to do it, when it can deal with the problem. All this does, essentially, is make whole the banking industry on the theory, which is backed by the stock market rising nearly 500 points, I don't know how it's done so far today, that if those things are okay, we'll all be okay.
No.
Not so.
Which is why I said if the stock market goes up as a result of some announcement or action in this thing, that's a sign it's the wrong thing to do. The stock market is the anti-indicator in this
well,
scenario.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't go that far.
I would.
I wouldn't go that far. Anyway, we've got a lot of callers.
Yes, we do. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You are listening to KBOO dot, or not dot FM. That's the Internet's address. 90.7 FM on your FM dial. Speaking of the Internet's address, I wrote some blog posts about Krugman's article, about the bailout plan in general, and about World Cup qualifying, which starts again up this weekend.
Well, I'm glad you did that, and I have to point out that if it weren't for your bicycle, we would have,
We would have what?
I don't know.
Okay.
Something better.
Who do we have? Jeff, good morning.
You're doing nothing better than you're doing right now. The outrage is palpable. Thanks, men, for taking my call. I hope you'll forgive me if I...
No!
Maybe.
Of course you won't, but whether or not you will, I'd like to step back for just a moment and say, Joe...
Yes?
And Abe. Joe, I was sorry to see you were so sanguine about the potential death of newspapers, considering professional writers, editors, fact-checkers. Abe, your contention that the...
I used to make close to $5,000 a year just writing articles for local press, and that income dried up.
That's because it's a professional field, and it takes real money to get real information and real investigation. Abe, your idea that the news consumer is needs to be savvy and sophisticated and somehow informed as what they pick on over the web, that's a troubling thing because I have a great fear that Wikipedia-style journalism is going to make it easier to confuse, to obfuscate.
Are you suggesting that the Wikipedia isn't factually based?
No, I'm saying that anybody that contends that the blogosphere, the internets themselves, or these non-professional news writers and the like, there's no fact-checking, there's no editor, there's no professionalism, and I'm not saying they're not professional, there's plenty of people that have gravitated to the internet, but I have trouble with the idea that fantasies, falsehoods, and so forth of your friends and neighbors on the internet, the whole world of speculation, should not be the intellectual foodstuffs of our children, and I am not in the least sanguine about the death of newspapers. I have ink that runs in my veins. I've been in newspapers for lo these 30 years, and I do not buy the idea. And here's come to what it comes down to. I don't buy the idea that we should all be savvy and sophisticated and get our information off of the internet because there is what is called the digital divide. And 1 hour a day at the library on an internet in lieu of a newspaper is no excuse for being an informed citizen. I'll leave it at that. I'll wait for your response, and I thank you for taking my call.
Oh, no problem. Well, okay. Jeff brings up a very relevant point, and that is that the journalistic outlets on the internet, such as they are, and there's not very many now. I'm talking about the websites that are doing good hard journalism, good reporting. There's more of them all the time, but there aren't that many now. What they lack is the sort of collective sense of trust in their journalistic integrity that existed around some of the major print outlets, like the New York Times, for example, like the Los Angeles Times, for example. These sites on the Internet don't have that sort of cachet. Now, it's also true that that cachet has been in many places, many times misplaced. For example, the New York Times famously printed a mea culpa for its failure to accurately report the facts in the run-up to the Iraq War. That really dealt the integrity of print journalism a pretty heavy blow, I think. So there's really right now no real repository for the faith of readers out there in the objectivity of their sources. So really, in many respects, the entire news delivery mechanism is in a sort of free fall right now. And it will eventually, I think, coalesce around a few sources that most people will regard as objective and sound. But I don't think we're there right now.
Well, you know, you're more hopeful than I am. The fact of the matter is that newspapers, there was a Ted Mehar, as a matter of fact, famously said, well, I don't know how famously, he said to me and many other people while he was actually working at the Oregonian, that the Oregonian's policy was what people didn't know couldn't hurt the Oregonian. And it was not a wrong insight. That is to say, always, the advantage of multiple press sources is absolute. And always, local newspapers, whether it's the L.A. Times or the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Sun Moon paper in Washington or any newspaper, including the Oregonian, always they have, through time, been less and less competent at reporting the news. All you have to do is look at the lead of any story in modern history, in late 20th century history, and then look at it in the more recent version, and you constantly discover that you don't get the who, what, when, how, and why of a news story. Instead, you get atmosphere and color and all sorts of things that tend to hinder your ability to grasp within the first three paragraphs what the hell the story is about.
Sure.
And the competence of journalists, and particularly the stupid talking heads on television, has become lower and lower in terms of their ability to report news. And what constitutes news has always been, since the days of Hearst and Pulitzer and all those guys, really sensational and often very surface and stupid. So, yeah, it's a loss, but you know what? We haven't had the kind of news reporting that is necessary to be a really knowledgeable people. The extremes of this, to my mind, are, on the one hand, the French press, which will tell you way more than you need to know and quote way more intellectuals than you need to hear from, on the one hand, and the flashy dumbness of the New York Post, the Rupert paper, on the other. So we aren't really, in terms of print journalism, ever effectively informing people. Moreover, the fact of the matter is that every study that's been done in recent times has shown that most people don't get their news from print journalism.
They get it from TV.
They get it from TV, and if you've been paying any attention to network TV or Fox or even MSNBC, which I happen to like, you realize that it's often opinion disguised as news, and more often than that, just outright nonsense.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. All right, we got a little biz to take care of here.
Biz.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, Linda Olson Osterlund speaks with journalist and historian Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 759 detainees in America's illegal prison, about the first definitive Guantanamo prisoner list. At 9:30, host Emily Young interviews Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America?, a critique of politicians, the media, and the food industry. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, news and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Greg Pallast talks about the anniversary of the Valdez spill and the economic meltdown.
Always listen to Greg. He knows his stuff.
Yes, but also, I think, too critical of those journalists on the Internet who are actually journalists. But I digress. Yeah. Also, a short interview with Malik Rahim of Common Ground Relief. At 11 on stage in studio, D. May Roberts welcomes guests from Northwest Children's Theater's production of Goodnight Moon. And producer Frank Reynolds talks to people around Portland about funding for the arts and the importance of culture in tough economic times. At 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews Vanessa Renwick about her new show at the New American Art Union.
Yeah, I went to the opening of that. It was great.
Oh, cool. Renwick works in experimental and poetic documentary forms and produces films, videos, and installations that explore the possibility of hope and contemporary society. All this and more coming up on your community radio station,
oh,
KBOO.
So much.
And
so
I would
much.
Encourage you to visit our website. Most of the news and public affairs shows now have a blog accompanying them, as does this show. So log on to www.kboo.fm/The Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Click on the blogs link and you can read more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we have callers who
we
stuck
do.
Around?
Joanne, good morning.
Yes, hello. I've been told by some people that know me. Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, okay. I thought somebody cut me off.
Does that happen a lot, Joanne?
I'm not answering. Anyway, some people that know me think I worry too much. And I heard recently that we're sending our troops to the Mexican border. Now,
yeah.
My question is this going to be the start of real repression and police state whatever in our country?
Well, it could be, but
I will hang up, dear. Goodbye.
Okay. This is way off of our topic, but just very briefly, I think people know this, but it's important to understand that, that Mexico is very close to being a failed state, because the vast wealth of the narco traffickers has come to dominate a lot of Mexican politics, particularly, well, everywhere, but particularly in the north. And the seemingly limitless desire to get high in the United States has produced a lawless state along the border. Juarez is a dangerous town. Tijuana is a dangerous town. And, you know, serious. And then when I say town, it's wrong. These are cities of a million or more people. The fact of the matter is that the question of people who want to work in the United States moving across the border is far less relevant right now than the problem of narcotics moving across the border and being moved by people who have absolutely no mercy and are well armed, very well armed. We send the guns south. The guns come back with the drugs. The drugs get sold here, which gets the money, which buys the guns, and so on.
All of this happening in the framework of the war on drugs, which exacerbates each of those.
Right. I mean, it's obvious that that part of what needs to happen is there needs to be a national drug policy that includes rehabilitation, and there needs to be, as far as I can see, a legalization and perhaps taxation of marijuana.
We should do a show on that.
No, we're never going to touch drugs. No drugs.
All
drugs
right.
are bad.
We got an email. BJ writes, as a non-citizen working on getting out back to Europe, I can't see any significant change being wrought by the mostly out-of-touch critters who have attached themselves to a well-meaning, smart, but increasingly under-attack president, much as I admire him personally. Writing as someone who has been bankrupted by becoming seriously sick and almost dying a couple of years ago, I've come to the conclusion that I don't want to expose myself to this catastrophic scenario again. I know that Europe has its share of problems, but there is at least a social safety net.
Yeah.
There's somebody who is thrown in the town.
Well, but in fact, right now in France, there are massive street demonstrations. It's also happening in other European countries, notably Greece, demanding the retention of and even the increase of these social networks. And the fact of the matter, these social services, and the fact of the matter is that given the economic situation, this is going to be a struggle in Europe.
Indeed. Yeah, the ruling investor classes in Europe are culpable in this mess, just as they are here in the United States.
Well, in fact, in the AIG mess, the main bad guys of it actually were in London.
Indeed, and payments have gone out to big banks in Germany and in France as well.
Yeah, and
American taxpayer dollars.
Yes.
Being
yes.
shelled out to fulfill contractual obligations made by a company that ran itself ragged.
Well,
it makes you mad, Joe.
Well, it does make one mad, and the fact of the matter is that obviously the ruling, the powers that be, don't really believe in capitalism, because if they did, they'd let all this stuff fail and let hell take over.
Yeah, they would let.
Not that I think that's the answer, but I'm just saying that, you know.
Yeah, indeed. So yeah, it's capitalism for everyone else, socialism for them.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, better give me my bonus, or I won't play ball at all.
Are you going to get a bonus?
No, I'm speaking as
oh,
a master of the universe.
Oh, I see.
You know that caller mentioned gladiators earlier? Maybe we ought to bring that back. Maybe we need big financiers in an arena fighting tigers with a spear.
No,
for the entertainment of me.
I think the sentiment is good, but I think what I want is the masters of the universe naked bare-knuckled fighting each other to the death in the Thunderdome.
Oh, okay.
I think that's the best way, and I think wars should be solved that way. The leaders of each country, you know, Obama could kick some serious ass. We get these guys in there, you know, naked, and anything goes, pulling on the whatever, you know, that'll be okay.
Yeah, see, the problem is if we do that with the financiers, though, they're going to sit down, cross their legs, and pout, and not agree to fight until they get their bonuses first.
No, you put a spear point to their, you know what, they'll get out there and fight.
All right, let's take some calls. Enough gladiator talk. Mike, good morning.
Hello.
Hey. What's on your mind?
Oh, love the discussion. Thanks for the call. I can put some good news on the permanence of information.
Okay.
It seems, you know, 7-8 years ago they started at the Library of Congress adapting and updating and solidifying all the information and books and letters and everything there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, did they go to a CD for that? No, they went to good old technology that is going to be reproducible fairly easily in the future.
What's that?
Get out your old 78s, except they're not made of vinyl. They're made of acetate.
Oh, they're actually going to preserve stuff on acetate records?
Yes, they're almost done. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, and as people probably know, various outfits are attempting to put every book in the world on the Internet.
That's brilliant. I really support efforts like that. Well, go ahead, Colin.
As long as it makes it to the acetate.
Right. Well, right, and as long as the acetate is in a vault somewhere that is safe and so on.
Well, that's the key, too. Also, the genetic knowledge of our plants. There's an island off of Norway that is, atomic bomb-proof and earthquake-proof and all those things way under the ground where they're saving seeds.
Yes.
Yes, there is this food bank, a seed bank.
Arc.
And, you know, we one show we definitely need to do is to talk about food and the state of food science right now. But
saving, yes.
Yeah, but you bring up some hopeful signs.
Trying to.
Thanks.
Hey, thank you very much.
Hey, bye.
All right, who's next? Sean, what's up?
Hey, I thought I'd mention, after the whole Enron Arthur Anderson thing, the only regulation that came about as a result of that was the Sarbanes-Oxley mark-to-market FASB 157 rules. And if there's any doubt about the current administration still being dominated by Wall Street, they're talking about undoing the mark-to-market rules on top of everything else.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I had just in passing talked about mark-to-market, and I think that rule should apply absolutely.
Well, why is Jeffrey Skilling still in prison? All he was doing was setting up off-balance sheet structured investment vehicles, just like the investment banks. And, you know,
because he got caught.
Yeah,
because
he got caught.
Right.
That's
the rule.
Where's the Justice Department crashing in on all of these Wall Street investment banks and commercial banks?
Well, now, come on.
Well, AIG is currently under criminal investigation, and I wouldn't be surprised to see quite a few of the other big investment houses join them.
I'll believe that when I see it. But
yeah, I'll believe it when I see it, too.
I think I might have a silver lining here. Taken in its totality, environmental recklessness and imperial foreign policy and corporate fascist domestic economic policy, I think, you know, there's no doubt that we're in what Morris Berman refers to as Dark Ages America, and who knows how long it's going to last. But the silver lining might be that there was a sinister side to FDR's New Deal, which was that it actually did help preserve capitalism.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He saved capitalism.
Yeah. Right. And these people apparently believe they're so overconfident that they don't even need to throw the population crumbs. So the contradictions are just going to continue to get worse and worse and worse.
Well, the only possibility that may interfere with your scenario, which I tend to agree with you, but the only thing that's possible is that there are a whole host of bank regulations and social service programs and so on to come down the line, and that if Obama can maintain his popularity and if the markets can be restabilized and so on, it is possible that we would finally have the necessary restoration, not improvement, but restoration of the reforms that characterized the Roosevelt era.
It is very telling, though, that the state budget deficits aren't even being made up by the stimulus package.
No, not even close.
they're just these Wall Street fascists. They're just so confident that they can just get away with everything now that they don't even need to throw the people, circuses, but no bread, right?
Right.
So
absolutely. No, I think your dire predictions may well turn out to be true. I am unwilling to quite succumb to them, although I must admit that if you were just to listen to what I say, you might get depressed.
Well, Marx talked about all this stuff 150 years ago. It's kind of amazing.
You know what I wish everyone would do? Everyone who's within the sound of our voices, I wish every one of them would carefully read the most simple of Marx's pieces, the tract, The Communist Manifesto, and get a good translation of it and read it. And part of what it talks about is the triumph of capitalism as well as the inevitable contradictions. It even mentions, en passant, the environmental crisis that capitalism produces. So I really think people should read that as part of their basic knowledge base.
Amen. Amen.
All right.
No, thanks, gentlemen.
You bet.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
I'm glad you mentioned that. The Communist Manifesto is a really interesting work. It is, it's very explicit about the defects and the excesses of capitalism, but it also is almost an homage to the dynamism of capitalism.
Yeah.
Marx acknowledges that capitalism, industrial capitalism, has in its power to solve the age-old problem of scarcity. But the problem is proper allocations of the goods and services that capitalism generates and the iniquity that follows. So I don't know that Marx was entirely anti-industrial.
Oh, no. He was not anti-industrial. He was not an eco-freak at all.
No. But he was definitely anti-iniquity, which is, ironically, part and parcel of both the dynamism and the excess of capitalism.
Well, and the arguments always are, can you in fact have a system that's built on the ever of necessity, the ever expanding markets, that doesn't run head on into environmental disaster or head on into people running out of money and not being willing to buy the crap that's being sold?
I think you can. And I think guys like Al Gore are suggesting ways we might do that. He never gives a speech without talking about the coming green economy as an absolutely a gold mine of money making opportunities. And there's also technologies that have yet to emerge, techniques that have yet to emerge. Like, as soon as somebody with the wherewithal gets into the idea, for example, of mining landfills for discarded resources, that's going to be an enormously profitable industry that will help clean up our environment at the same time. So the model of capitalism that demands a constantly expanding resource base might not necessarily be inviolable. It's just a question of what we consider to be resources and how we access them.
I will agree with you on that, but I predict that the people who run things right now will keep on running things right now because the people who are trying to do the good thing, and I'm assuming Obama is among them, simply have neither the power nor the vision to do it.
Right. Obama needs simply, first of all, to boot out the entire boards of directors of every company that's received a government bailout. Sorry, you guys screwed up. You ruined your company.
Yeah, we own it. You're out.
We own it. You're out. We're going to find somebody who's actually good at their jobs. And no, not only do you not get your bonuses, but you got to pay them back. And furthermore, you got to pay back every dollar you made during this whole orgy of fake money making that went on with the mortgage derivative trade.
But you do understand that the Constitution doesn't allow, it does not allow for punishment after the fact if there wasn't a law to cover it.
Yeah, that's true. But the Constitution does allow for contracts to be renegotiated in the case of an extremity. It's something called force majeure.
Yes.
That's when there's some big externality happens and contracts that were established in a more sane and rational time have to be reevaluated. My aunt, who works for Northwest Airlines, after 9/11, Northwest said it was exercising force majeure because of this incredible externality, the terrorist attack, and the impact that it had on the air travel industry afterwards. Her wages were reduced. The wages of all the union workers at Northwest were reduced, and there was not a dang thing they could do about it. So this argument from people like the executives at AIG, for example, that their contracts can't be voided is false. Their contracts can absolutely be voided.
No, I
government, as an owner, no less, can exercise force majeure because of the grievous externality that is the global financial meltdown. But, Obama's not doing it. Why? Because I think, and it really pains me to say this, I think that the masters of the universe are still the masters of the universe, and they will be until they're forcibly kicked out. So there.
So there?
Yeah.
So until next week, and keeping on with keeping on, you want to stay tuned to KBOO. We are the best, seriously, and you should tell others to listen to us online or directly on the radio, and you should stick around because we got some great programming, as always.
We'll see you next week.
Good morning. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives. Linda Olson Osterlund speaks with journalist and historian Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 759 detainees in America's illegal prison, about the first definitive Guantanamo prisoner list. Stay tuned.
This is the community calendar for Tuesday, March 24th. The YWCA of Greater Portland, along with Raphael House of Portland, invites you to a presentation and discussion on the criminal justice response to human trafficking, presented by Deputy District Attorney Greg Mowat and victim advocate Emily Hyde, on Wednesday, March 25th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at YWCA of Greater Portland, downtown facility, 1111 Southwest 10th Avenue, Portland. The Socialist Party of Oregon hosts a public forum tonight, Tuesday, March 24th, from 8:30 to 10 p.m. at the Red and Black Cafe, 400 Southeast 12th Avenue. Meets every fourth Tuesday. For more information, call Walt Brown at 503-636-4150. IWW Radical Movie Night is tonight, Tuesday, March 24th, from 7 to 10 p.m. at Liberty Hall, 311 North Ivy, where international workers of the world show radical movies every last Tuesday. Cheap entertainment, food, and friends. Mount Tabor Presbyterian Church conducts weekly divorce care for kids programs to help children heal from the pain of divorce and separation. Everyone is welcome each Wednesday evening at 7 to 8 p.m. at Mount Tabor Presbyterian Church, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street. Information and links are at the church website, www.mounttaborchurch.net. The People's Farmers Market takes place Wednesdays, 2 to 7 p.m. It's a year-round market at 3029 Southeast 21st Avenue, one block north of Powell Boulevard. For more information, call Ariana Jacob at 503-232-9051. There is a free sack lunch concert Wednesday, March 25th at noon at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. Anna Kazakova, soprano, and Andy Young, piano, present the best of Russian art song and beautiful arias of your choice, Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky, Mozart, Puccini, and American love songs. Do you want to take that next step as a member and become a volunteer? There are many varied trainings and events you can be part of. Contact Ani, KBOO Volunteer Coordinator. Email at volunteer@kboo.fm or call the station at 503-231-8032, extension 213. This has been Paula for the Community Calendar for KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio transmitting from Portland, Corvallis, and Hood River.
Good morning. It's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. Welcome to the Tuesday Radio Zine. First on Political Perspectives, Linda Olson Osterlund speaks with journalist and historian Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of 759 detainees in America's illegal prison, about the first definitive Guantanamo prisoner list. At 9:30, host Emily Young interviews Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? A critique of politicians, the media, and the food industry. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, news and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, on Flashpoints, Greg Palast talks about the anniversary of the Valdez spill and the economic meltdown. Also, a short interview with Malik Rahim of Common Ground Relief. At 11, on Stage and Studio, Dime Roberts welcomes guests from Northwest Children's Theater's production of Good Night Moon. And producer Frank Reynolds talks to people around Portland about funding for the arts and the importance of culture in tough economic times. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Ava Lake interviews Vanessa Renwick about her new show at the New American Art Union. Renwick works in experimental and poetic documentary forms and produces films, videos, and installations that explore the possibility of hope in contemporary society. Now let's go to Political Perspectives with host Linda Olson Osterlund.
get rid of the dictator. Rebuild your country, make sure all your kids go.
Good morning, and thank you for joining me on KBOO's Political Perspectives. I'm Linda Olsen Osterlund, and coming to us by phone from London this morning is my guest, author, journalist, and human rights activist Andy Worthington. As the author of the book, The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, he's just released the definitive Guantanamo prisoner list. Welcome to KBOO, Andy.
Hello, Linda. It's good to be back.
Oh, yes. I'm happy to have you again. Now, this list is the result of over 3 years of research on your part. Would you talk about what we can learn from it about the men who are imprisoned there or were imprisoned there, and also about those who put them there?
Yeah. Well, basically, it goes back to 3 years ago when I first started to research the stories of the people in Guantanamo, which came about because... Actually, there were two events that happened in the spring of 2006. There was a film released called The Road to Guantanamo, which followed the stories of three British citizens who had been there. And also Mozam Begg's book was released. Now, Mozam was also a British prisoner. And his story particularly fascinated me because Mozam had spent an enormous amount of time in solitary confinement. He actually spent nearly 2 years in Guantanamo in solitary confinement. And his story was kind of lightly peppered with these occasional meetings with other prisoners. I mean, he had so little contact with other prisoners. It was extraordinary. And it was really through these glimpses of the other prisoners that I really wanted to know, well, who are these people? And, of course, you know, this was 4 years after the prison had opened, but accurate information about who was there was still hard to come by. Now, I was fortunate that when I started my research in earnest, the Associated Press won a lawsuit against the Pentagon, forcing Donald Rumsfeld to release information about who was held there. So the names and nationalities of the prisoners and transcripts of the tribunals that had taken place at Guantanamo, these kind of rather crooked system of reviews that had been held there to ascertain to the military satisfaction whether they had correctly designated the prisoners as enemy combatants when they captured them. Now, they were nothing like a legal process. The prisoners didn't have lawyers, they weren't allowed to see or hear secret evidence against them, and they weren't allowed to hear where any of the evidence had come from. But they did provide the first opportunity for a lot of them to put their side of the story across. And it was by coming up with a chronology based on all these stories and by trying to get to grips with who these people were that I was able to put the book together. Now, the book didn't feature all the stories. My publishers drew the line.
How dare they? I read that book, and I could have read all the stories.
But, it was my intention when the book came out, which was about a year and a half ago, to make sure that as time went on, I would compile the rest of the stories that I was unable to include, and that eventually I would come up with a list so that anybody who was interested would be able either to seek out references to these prisoners through online articles that I've been writing over the last 2 years, or if they're not online, then to find where they are in the book, so that there's one comprehensive database, really, so that people can investigate, I think, really, who they believe, you know. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to just interrupt and say, and we can put a face to all of this namelessness, and we can see, you know, you can just go to Google and click on, put Guantanamo and click on images, and you can see these different prisoners being led here and there. You can see hands coming through bars, but it's easier for Americans, I believe, especially now under Obama, to just, they're not people we know about, and maybe they're terrorists. And this book allows you to really hear the real stories of how they were picked up and who they are and what kind of people they are. And I think it's important that we don't be good Germans and turn our head and pretend there aren't real people enduring real serious harm.
Well, I mean, that's what I'd hope, really, because that is the important thing. And I mean, you've raised a number of important issues there, really. I mean, when photographers go to Guantanamo, they're prohibited from taking any photos which might identify people. Now, obviously, the Pentagon lays this down for security reasons, but, you know, coincidentally, it also, as you say, prevents them from being humanized. They're never quite visible. You never quite know who they are. You know, and it's not just in the States. I mean, it's around the world, really, since the 9/11 attacks, that the there's been this encouragement by governments to dehumanize people and to think of them all as terrorists. And, you know, and it was... I didn't know when I started my research what I was going to discover. It was only as those patterns really emerged. And, I mean, they were also... The documents released by the government were also studied by the Seton Hall Law School, and those reports are available online that, you know, according to the government's own supposed evidence against the prisoners, once you started to break it down into where people were captured, then you realized that people were pulled off buses and seized in the street in Pakistan and were seized in random raids on houses, which were supposed to be based on intelligence, but clearly in so many cases were based on the fact that bounty payments were being offered, that the Pakistani government was having its arm twisted to hand over prisoners to U.S. forces. I mean, there are, you know, that's just one example, really. I mean, there are so many stories of prisoners who were seized in Pakistan who said, you know, quietly, while the CIA or FBI agents weren't looking, you know, the local Pakistani forces would say, we're sorry about this, but, you know, this is what we have to do for our relationship.
Well, and they were also sold. I mean, many were paid $5,000 apiece for these individuals. And I'm speaking with London-based journalist and Oxford graduate Andy Worthington about the list that he's published on all of the prisoners who've been held in Guantanamo. You've, in the last, just since 2007, there's been 140 prisoners released, and you have written about all of them. One of the things that keeps surfacing in the right wing here is that some of the prisoners released have reverted to terrorism and have taken up arms against the United States. Can you say anything about those kinds of allegations?
Well, I can, yeah. I mean, and I think there are a few points here, Linda. I mean, one is that the Pentagon repeatedly keeps putting out differing figures and not substantiating its claims. Now, the Seton Hall Law School, who I mentioned before, who've done a lot of research, have really doggedly pursued this one over the years to demonstrate that there's no kind of stability to anything that the Pentagon is coming up with. They don't back up what they've said, and on occasions when they have done, they've they accused people of speaking out as being against about what had happened to them as being equivalent to returning to the battlefield.
Can you repeat now, the organization you said, the Seton? Can you say that
Seton,
one more?
Yeah, it's Seton Hall Law School. It's in New Jersey.
And they have also done this research, you're saying?
Yeah, they've done a lot of reports based on documents produced by the Pentagon. Very good reports.
And it's nice to have a source that can refute these kinds of things. My husband has run up into that kind of accusation just in casual conversations at work.
Right, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and I mean, you know, clearly there are various aspects whereby there may well be some people that they let go. Now, there are some reasons why they let people go because they didn't know what they were doing. That certainly happened in the first few years of Guantanamo. They released prisoners back to Afghanistan. And then later on claimed that these people had joined up with the Taliban. And completely, the right-wing press completely ignored the fact that senior officials in Afghanistan had been saying, we were never allowed to come and see who they were holding in Guantanamo. We weren't even allowed to see these people when they were released back into Afghanistan. If they were members of the Taliban, we would have known that. So it was the fault of the U.S. It was the fault of the Pentagon again that they'd released people without consulting with anybody else about who they had.
Well, and what seems to get ignored was there was no legal process engaged in to determine whether there was guilt or innocence on the part of anyone who's been released.
Absolutely.
Really, it's been strictly outside of any legal context. So, you know, it, once again, that falls to our government to have done any kind of legal process that would have substantiated or not the allegations.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, and it remains that way to this day, that there are no clear lines that can be drawn anywhere about actually what they're doing, because, trying to rebuild something that looks as though it conforms to legal standards after everything that's happened is you know, an almost impossible task. And so, you know, they are stuck. And I mean, you know, obviously there's an element of this which people regularly say, which is, you know, well, if I was held in Guantanamo and I hadn't been a terrorist, I would be when I came out. Now, I think that there may well be some instances of a handful of people who were radicalized by what happened. Either that, or there were people who they didn't recognize that they had genuinely dangerous people. But, you know, the thing I would say in response to that as well is that having met people who were released from Guantanamo and having read the stories of so many more and heard about so many more, you know, it's not a very easy job to turn somebody who isn't a terrorist into a terrorist. It's an extraordinary thing to do, to persuade somebody to you know, put themselves in that way of, you know, being a suicide bomber, for example.
Well, also, the kind of trauma that these men have endured is more likely to create someone fearful and physically ill.
Right, exactly.
Then someone. I wanted to point out that you have said, I think, that over 90% of the people at Guantanamo are likely innocent. And as recently as March 20th, one of the U.S. officials, Lawrence B. Wilkerson, I don't know if you heard about this.
I do. I was very glad to see that. And said that.
He was the chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, and he's a lifetime military man. And he has said straight out that the U.S. leadership was aware that the overwhelming majority of those that they had transported to Guantanamo were innocent from the very earliest stages, and that it was actually incompetence in the conduct of the war in Afghanistan that led to that, and that they just never wanted to release them because they didn't want to be embarrassed. And that's a pretty high American official stating that.
Well,
for
no,
those
absolutely.
Who doubt.
And I mean, you know, I was very impressed by his article that he, you know, that he had drawn on. I mean, he was presumably drawing on information that wasn't available to me.
Yes.
You know, he had some insider information that hasn't been made publicly available about the level of incompetence. But I mean, when it comes to the brick wall that people like Wilkerson ran up against, I mean, that was very clearly, you know, Donald Rumsfeld and David Addington. I know of instances. In both of those cases, I mean, Jane Mayer talks about it in her book, The Dark Side, where they absolutely refused to discuss any of the details about who they'd captured as far as they were concerned. You know, there was a meeting where Gordon England, a senior Pentagon official, and somebody else who, I can't remember who that is at the moment, but went to see David Addington, Cheney's then legal counsel, later his chief of staff, about the problems. I mean, this was after a CIA agent had been to Guantanamo and had interviewed, I think, about one-tenth of the people there and had come away just incredulous at how the people that he'd seen shouldn't have been there. But when senior officials tried to have a meeting with Addington, Addington said, "We're not discussing this. There is no discussion going to take place. The president has decided they're all enemy combatants. That's the end of the story. No review." You know, and there are plenty of stories as well about I mean, I think Condoleezza Rice tried to raise the issue of the detainees with Rumsfeld, and he would just storm out of the room saying, "I don't do detainees." You know.
So there was a brick wall that wouldn't allow the truth to arise, but we have a new administration now, and in a minute I'd like to talk more about that with you. This is Linda Olson-Osterlund for KBOO 90.7, and I'm talking with my guest Andy Worthington. He's a London-based journalist, published in The Guardian and in The Huffington Post, Counterpunch, many other online articles that you can see, and then, of course, his own website, which is full of really not exaggerating, great articles that are there. I wondered if while you're doing these stories and you're listening to all these, you're reading these stories, you're seeing these photos, and you're taking this in, have there been any particular stories that have stuck with you that your mind just keeps going back to? Any particular individual prisoners?
Well, I think over the years, obviously, there've been all kinds of prisoners. You know, I've always been very affected by some of the stories of some of the young men who've been held in Guantanamo. Omar Khadr, the Canadian, and Mohammed Jawad, an Afghan, who were both put forward for the war crimes trials that were invented by Cheney and Addington, you know.
Yes, young men. I also know there's one young man who went in with his father. I'm not remembering his name now. He's been kept there for all of this time, almost 7 years, separate from his father, not allowed to ever see his father, though he's still there in the same place. And I believe his mind has gone completely. They say he spreads the walls of the of his cell with his own feces and bangs his head on the wall.
You know, and I mean, there are as much as the lawyers who represent the prisoners have done what they can for them. You know, there are still prisoners there who didn't want to have legal support. So there are still people in there who have no contact with the outside world whatsoever. And of course, the lawyers are, you know, often the prisoners' only kind of human lifeline. But what can they do? The years go by, the prisoners see no hope that, you know, they might come in with these stories of great court victories that have happened over the years. You know, there have been significant court victories,
right,
but none of them have resulted in any of them being freed. And
let's talk about that under Obama then. Also, I'm very concerned about what's been happening since his administration has taken place. You know, Admiral Walsh came out with the report that Obama had asked for, a report, a review of the prisoners held at Guantanamo and of the conditions, and he had ordered that their conditions be kept to meet all international and national standards of care for prisoners. And Admiral Walsh came up with the report right on time and said, gee whiz, you know, it's pretty good there. Everybody, the standards, Geneva Convention standards are being met, and we're going to change a few things, but people are doing well. They also claim publicly that there's no solitary confinement, though the overwhelming majority are in fact held in. So let's talk about this. You wrote an article about the CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights, wrote a refutation to that report, including the attorneys' discussions of letters they had received just in January and February of this year from prisoners. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing that when you were going through what the review said, I mean, you know, the main problem with it is that they say that prisoners are not kept in solitary confinement because they define their cells as single occupancy cells. Well, yes, they are, but in them they're held in almost complete solitary confinement. And, you know, and it's always important to remember the difference between this prison and the maximum security prisons that they're modelled on. And, you know, most of the prisoners are held in two blocks that are modeled on high-security cell blocks in the United States. It's that everybody in the United States prisons has been tried and convicted of a crime, you know, and knows what their sentence is, whereas these guys have this open-ended imprisonment, which, as far as they know, could last forever without them ever having a chance to prove their innocence or, you know, or to have a trial to where it would be established that they were guilty of something. And I think the mental stress of that is, you know, that's a factor that Walsh's review didn't even take into account. But also, of course, there's been a big hunger strike raging at Guantanamo, and the government claims that it's acting humanely by preventing prisoners from killing themselves by starving themselves to death. But the method that it uses to treat them is regarded by medical professionals as inhumane, which is strapping them down to a restraint chair twice a day and force feeding them,
which is actually a very brutal process. They're often beaten on the way to there. I've seen film footage of actual not at Guantanamo but of force feeding. It's very, very violent. The person
it's
if
absolutely
they
horrible, you know. And I think the thing with this review is that it's, you know, it came from the top, so, you know, Walsh and probably senior officials talked to people, and then it kind of went down the chain of command. They had a quick look around and everybody tidied everything up. And everything looked great. And so as a result, they can go away and tick all the boxes and say, yeah, Geneva Conventions will be fine. Just give them film night every now and then, let them out a bit more often. Now, I'm not saying that that's not required and that wasn't a good idea. But really, to change what was happening there and to follow through on his promise to close Guantanamo, I think that President Obama needed to do something much bigger, and that somebody needed to go there in person to you know, to express that there was sincerely going to be a change. Because for the prisoners there, why would they believe it? They've been there for 7 years.
And they've got to all know about the Uyghurs who've been ordered to be released more than once and have people willing to accept them into their care. These are the 17 Chinese, they were captured in China. They're captured in Afghanistan, refugees from China. Uyghur is their ethnicity. And even though a court ordered it and they began packing up their stuff, they were held and are still held. And that's that extrajudicial behavior has not really been changed under Obama. I know he changed the name. We're no longer going to call them enemy combatants. Can you say anything about that?
Well, he did, and he, you know, importantly, I think he said that he didn't believe that the president had the power to act unilaterally, and that everything that he did had to be approved by Congress. But you know that the document where the Justice Department said they were no longer going to use the term enemy combatant, when it came down to whatever they were going to call them, which wasn't decided, but they still gave themselves, you know, the opportunity to hold people in rather dubious circumstances for having really quite tangential connections to terrorist activities, and in fact, you know. Claimed, as the Bush administration had, that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were the same thing, whereas, of course, one of them is a former government of Afghanistan, which has now become, you know, an insurgent organization in the eyes of U.S. forces, and the other is a small but lethal terrorist group responsible for the 9/11 attacks. They're not the same thing at all.
Exactly.
You know, and he really hasn't struck to the heart of that problem, which I think... you know, it bled through the entire military system when the Bush administration was in charge, that instead of having a principled military force which held prisoners humanely and decently as enemy prisoners of war, it just fed through the entire system that everybody who ended up in the hands of U.S. forces was potentially a terror suspect. You know, and that's how the wars have been conducted both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. That, you know, for the U.S. soldiers, they're soldiers fighting a war. For the people of Afghanistan, if they fight against them. For the people of Iraq, if they fight against them, they're terrorists.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing that I'm concerned about is that it seems if Obama actually accepted this review and accepts it as face value and doesn't ask for a more in-depth review and doesn't accept... I know that the Center for Constitutional Rights sent their report, which is very well documented, to Obama as well. I'm waiting to see if Obama is going to accept these superficial reviews or if he intends to do something different. At this stage, I don't think we know that even if he closes Guantanamo, that the prisoners there will have the kind of outcome that they actually should have based on their crimes or innocence.
Yeah, well, there are two things to me, really. You know, one is that we're 2 months in and he's only released one person, and that was a British resident who was such a notorious torture victim that it was embarrassing the government on both sides of the Atlantic. He is reviewing their cases, but there are cleared prisoners in Guantanamo, and not all of them are from countries where they, like the Uyghurs, who can't be returned to China. There are some of them from countries where it shouldn't be difficult for them to be returned. You know, there are 6 Saudis who've been cleared for release. And there's a long-standing arrangement with the Saudi government. Why are they still there? I don't understand that. You know, I think I was expecting him to act sooner. Now, maybe the mention last week that possibly some prisoners will be accepted into the United States, and now that might be the Uyghurs. I think that really should happen because that sends a good message out to other countries who the administration wants to help to take cleared prisoners.
Well, and every day that these people are held there, they deteriorate. That's the bottom line. And according to reports from the attorneys, that guards have become more violent since Obama came in. I don't know how to attribute that, but in that CCR report, some of the prisoners are saying that the guards have upped the level of random violence.
Yeah, I know. I've heard that as well, which is very disturbing. And I mean, it's why I said really that I think the change of administration required some significant change at Guantanamo for somebody to really go in there rather than just commissioning a report and saying, look, we need to run this place more as a kind of holding camp now for what's going to happen to people. There's a small number of people who eventually will face some sort of trial. And there's a majority of people in here who really, you know, are not going to stay here, and they're going to be released.
Well, for now, we're going to have to leave it there, Andy, I'm sorry to say. I think this is an ongoing story. I mean, I know it's an ongoing story and something we need to keep paying attention to. And I want to let the cable audience know that they can go and find out more about Guantanamo always by looking at your writings. And they can go to www.andyworthington.co.uk. And it links to many, many other things. But the information available just instantly on there is really excellent, and I continue to turn to you as a source of information about Guantanamo. So thank you so much for joining us here today and for the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, Linda, for the latest installment, and you know, let's hope we get to talk again, but more importantly, let's hope that, you know, we see some action from President Obama in closing the place down.
Yes, and with the right disbursement of the prisoners there, with one that cares for justice.
Exactly.
Well, thank you again, and I'm going to tell the cable audience coming up next is Emily Young. She interviews Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? And I'll leave you going out with music by Dave Rovix. It's While We Torture Our Prisoners.
After we torture our prisoners, we'll bring you decades of peace, spiritual release, free religious expression. You can say what you want in the papers you run, we'll never force a confession. After we torture our prisoners.
Tune into the KABU Yiddish Hour on Sunday, March 29th, as we look at the concepts of eco-kashrut, a growing movement to reinterpret Jewish dietary laws. Eco-kashrut expands on traditional kosher practice by incorporating the ethics of sustainable growing systems, humane animal production, and fair treatment for farm workers. We'll be talking to some of the movement's primary shapers, as well as a couple of Portland's own Jewish organic farmers. So save the date, Sunday, March 29th at 10 a.m., right here on KABU, and tell your friends.
KABU is a proud co-sponsor of Tar Sands Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent with author Andrew Nikiforuk. Proceeds will benefit KABU Community Radio. This presentation will explore the dangers and destructiveness of tar sand oil production, a signature of peak oil. The event is sponsored by Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. That's Tar Sands with author Andrew Nikiforuk, Tuesday, March 31st from 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. More information is available by phone 503-232-5495.
It's 9:30. You're listening to the Tuesday Radio Zine on KBOO Portland 90.7. Still to come at 10, it's Air Cascadia News and Commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Greg Palace talks about the anniversary of the Valdez spill and the economic meltdown. Also a short interview with Malik Rahim of Common Ground Relief. At 11 on Stage and Studio, D-May Roberts welcomes guests from Northwest Children's Theater's production of Goodnight Moon. And producer Frank Reynolds talks to people around Portland about funding for the arts and the importance of culture in tough economic times. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Ava Lake interviews Vanessa Renwick about her new show at the New American Art Union. Renwick works in experimental and poetic documentary forms and produces films, videos, and installations that explore the possibility of hope in contemporary society. Up next, host Emily Young interviews Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, a critique of politicians, the media, and the food industry.
Thank you.
welcome everybody. Good morning, and if all the buttons are working, Joel Berg has joined us today. Joel, are you there?
I am indeed, and I'm thrilled to be following that uplifting gospel music instead of that torture song.
That was Ry Cooter, and it was about having to bring a woman home as pay, but I thought the very thing that makes you rich makes me poor. Hi, Joel. I'm Emily Young, and I want to tell folks about your book, All You Can Eat, How Hungry is America? And I have to tell you first that the cover is what sold me on this book, because it's an old diner sign, which I just love, and I feel like asking for two sides.
Well, there you have it. And I'm so glad the publisher worked with me to do that, because most books on hunger have sort of a maudlin picture of a starving child on the cover. And most books on hunger are fairly maudlin, honestly. Mine has a little humor in it. Someone praised my good-natured snarkiness. So I think the cover reflects the tone of the book, but it's obviously about an issue that's deadly serious. But we can show a little of the ridiculous irony of having hunger in a society with so much wealth and so much agricultural plenty.
Right. And of course, you've done a lot of background work, very heavily researched, and yet isn't heavy, which I thank you for that. I want to dive right in to let you know that I myself am ramen rich and probably root canal poor. And in Oregon, as you state in your book, that our food insecurity rates are higher than our poverty rates. And food insecurity, which I'm feeling, as you say, food insecure enough to eat a horse, is the new phrase for hunger. Is that right?
That's correct. In the Clinton administration, we helped develop a methodology that described the broader notion of food insecurity, that for most people in America who didn't have enough food, it wasn't quite as bad as Darfur or North Korea, because we still have a federal nutrition safety net. People weren't starving in the streets. They were more likely to be choosing between food and rent, choosing between food and medicine. But then we said that a subset of that characterization, the most severe form of food insecurity, should be described as hunger. People actually skipping meals, having pangs of lack of food. And the Bush administration actually stopped using the term hunger entirely, instead using the term very low food security, which does sort of have an Orwellian twist to it. I think if we have newspaper headlines all the time, and I collect newspaper references and pop culture references to hunger, if we can say if you've gone an hour without your Snickers bar, if you're hungry, if Venus and Serena Williams or Tiger Woods are hungry for a win, if an executive's hungry for their next promotion, I think we can certainly say that people who lack enough food are hungry.
Now let's tell folks why you know so much about this and who you are exactly. Joel Berg worked under Dan Glickman in the USDA under Bill Clinton. Is that correct?
That's correct. Dan Glickman was the Secretary of Agriculture, my immediate boss, and I was a political appointee in the Clinton administration, and I did spend all 8 years of the Clinton administration at the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Right, and you are now currently the Executive Director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger.
I am indeed. We are an umbrella group for the more than 1,200 soup kitchens and food pantries in New York City, and they serve a startling 1.3 million low-income New Yorkers.
And also, the book that you've written is actually a treatise that you are planning to take. It came out before you knew the outcome of the election, but you plan on taking it to the President of the United States and offering it to him as a guideline to how to cure hunger in America. You believe that it's possible. How quick is it possible if we follow your guidelines?
Well, President Obama has actually called for ending child hunger in America by 2015 as a down payment on ending all hunger in America. So I believe that is actually a very realistic goal. And I must say, my book is extraordinarily critical of the American political establishment for not more thoroughly addressing this issue in the last few decades. I point out that when government did address this issue in the 1960s and 1970s by creating the safety net programs that we have today, although in tattered form, that we had dramatic progress in reducing hunger. So the single most important takeaway point from my book for folks is that it's not a hopeless situation, that we don't have just an automatically fixed level of hunger. It's not set by nature like the size of the Cascade Mountains. I always try to get local references. Hunger goes up or down based on human actions and particularly governmental actions. And now that we have a president who's pledged to end child hunger and he's really put his money where his mouth is, serious money in the stimulus package with great support from people like Senator Wyden, serious money in his budget, we have a real hope for the first time in a very long time that we can finally end hunger in America.
Some of the facts in your books, up until, of course, Chapter 12, when you start outlining the cure, were things that shocked and surprised me. I didn't realize that many states require fingerprints from food stamp recipients and the amount of trouble that people have to go to. And, of course, now it's called SNAP. That is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. People are actually having to give fingerprints in lieu of what's gone on with the bailouts and just money given away willy-nilly to corporations and CEOs. And again, you address this in your book pretty specifically, giving actual numbers and names of what is expected of corporate welfare and as opposed to people on assistance programs. When did the fingerprinting come into play and go on a little bit more about that?
You know, fingerprinting came into play in the late 1990s in a handful of states. Now it's only exists in four states. My supposedly liberal, but not really liberal, home state of New York, California, Arizona, and Texas. And you do mention my comparisons to corporate welfare. You know, I wrote the book about a year and a half ago, and my opening line for my chapter on inequality of wealth was, the last time we had this much inequality of wealth was 1929, and we know what happened after that. And I don't think I was particularly prescient. I think the people who cared to look understood that if you had this much inequality of wealth, the society could not last and could not prosper. And I contrast in mind-numbing detail, but fun mind-numbing detail, you know, the ease with which corporations get their welfare with the difficulty with which a poor working family gets food stamps. Finger imaging does not prevent fraud. The four states with finger imaging or fingerprinting, it's sort of an electronic way of fingerprinting, actually have higher rates of error in the food stamps program than the 46 states that don't. Oregon doesn't have more fraud in the food stamps program because it doesn't treat poor people automatically like criminals. The reasons we have fingerprinting in New York is politics, that our elected officials get to stand up saying, we're tough on poor people, we're tough on fraud, even though it does nothing except waste taxpayer money. And the other thing is the companies that control the technology and get money from these contracts lobby heavily against eliminating. So it's a ridiculous system. But we have a long history in America, as I point out in my book, of blaming the victim. Other countries early in their histories developed social welfare systems. We developed debtor's prison. So if you're poor, you go to prison. You know, the funny thing is, when I wrote my book, I thought I was going to be really out there on corporate welfare. Now it's sort of old hat. I'm pretty moderate.
You really are. You kind of pulled your punches, in retrospect.
I thought it was tough a year and a half ago, and people say, this is radical. I called for corporate executives paying their fair share of taxes, and maybe instead of having seven vacation homes, have five vacation homes, and pay their workers enough to feed their families with the money saved. Now there's a Republican, conservative Republican senator from Iowa saying AIG executives should commit hari-kari. I'm pretty moderate. I just say they should pay their fair share of taxes and pay their workers enough so they don't starve. That's moderate.
It is so gross, and even you mentioned Goldman Sachs as an example, and then having them be part of the bailout is glaring, and the fact that they had record profits in 2006.
I do find it ironic that everyone seems to be up in arms. Oh, my God, government money is going to failing corporations that we're supporting. You know, like the scene from Casablanca when they find the gambling here. I'm shocked. There's been corporate welfare in America for decades and decades and decades. That money's come out of programs that could have been helping low-income working families, poor families, and families struggling to stay in the middle class, could have helped them with food, could have helped them with affordable housing. And frankly, now that the elites of society, and some of the mainstream media elites have their own stock portfolios in trouble. Now they're shocked. Now they're outraged. I agree people should be outraged that AIG is still giving bonuses, but this is not a new thing. As I point out in the book, Goldman Sachs, one of the wealthiest corporations on the planet, in 2006, the average employee got $600,000 bonuses, and they were getting tens of millions of dollars from city, state, and federal government to build a sparkling new headquarters just a few blocks from their own headquarters, which was just a few decades old. You know, the Colosseums lasted a few thousand years in Rome. I can't imagine a corporate headquarters couldn't last, you know, more than 40 years without our tax dollars paying for a new one.
Right. And I want to remind people who've just joined us, we're speaking with Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? This outlines the problem and problems with just the misspending and the wrong allotment of our funds going to corporations, and how the hungry have been undercut in this country. And now people just have a hard time believing that there's any hungry people in America, and that if they're hungry, they're probably hungry due to mental health reasons, or maybe they're lazy, or they're drug addicted. But that's really not the case, is it? Most hungry people are working families, people who are working often more than two jobs, three jobs, and trying to live on $28.30 of food. You, along with our governor and quite a few other people, took the challenge in April of 2007 to eat as if you were on food stamps. How did that go for you?
It was tough. I must say, you know, for all the bad news in Oregon about hunger, the only good news is, while elected officials in other parts of the country sort of blame the messenger, and when USDA put out figures about how hunger was increasing in their state, they just denied it. In Oregon, your leaders actually started doing something about it. I think it's incredibly wonderful that your governor, the highest-ranking elected official arguably in the state, decided to live for a week the way the least powerful do on the food stamps program. And I must say, I'm not just sucking up because I'm coming to Portland tonight for a reading at Powell's, but, you know, Senator Wyden's been really great on this. So living on the food stamps diet for $28.30 for a week was tough. My partner cooked everything from scratch and shopped for me because I was out ranting about hunger and doing my other stuff. And even then, it was extraordinarily difficult. I barely survived. I couldn't afford a single organic product. I couldn't afford a single beverage. So I could get a mealy 30-cent apple from a store across the street. I live down the street in Brooklyn, New York, from an amazing farmer's market, and I could not afford a single product there, could not afford even a 50-cent apple. I had a Jewish mother who I was supposed to spend Mother's Day with. We always went out to Chinese food, not to be stereotypical, but we did. I explained to her dozens of times before the state that I couldn't go out to a restaurant with her because you can't use food stamps at a restaurant, and by the way, I couldn't afford it anyway if I could. And she said, yes, I fully understand. And then she offered me food 17 times that day. Yes, I counted 17 times. So, yeah, there are psychological impacts about not having enough food. There are physiological impacts about not having enough food. But this week also reminded me just how central food is to our daily sort of family and human existence. We socialize around food. I couldn't go out to, you know, to eat with colleagues. I couldn't go out to eat, with friends. So it was really challenging. One other point I'd make is, you know how the Hollywood stars who need free things the least get it the most? They go to these big awards ceremonies and they get swag bags full of stuff. Well, white-collar workers such as myself get free food all the time. It really struck me during this week. I go to a breakfast meeting with food. I go to a lunch meeting with food. I go to a reception honoring some hunger group, mine or some others, and the shrimp cocktail are flowing almost as freely as the regular cocktails. And so the people who need free food least in society get it all throughout their lives. The people who need it the most have to get fingerprinted to apply for food stamps.
At the time you wrote this book, Joel Berg, the hunger problem has increased dramatically. What do you think's happened since a year ago when you finished this book?
Well, as I wrote the book, I said things had gone from bad to worse. We were just starting an economic downturn, and food banks, food pantries, soup kitchens were simply running out of food to meet the growing demand. Now, my partner cringes when I use this phrase because it's horrible English, but I'll use it anyway. Things have gone from worse to worser. If hunger was a river overflowing its banks in past years, now it's just a tidal wave. In New York City, there was a 28% increase in people using food pantries and soup kitchens over the last year, and even worse than that, or worser than that, if I may, two-thirds of the pantries and kitchens in New York City ran out of food. So another key point of my book is that, please, the public should not be conned into believing that charities are solving this problem. They are not. They are barely scratching the surface. Trying to end hunger, which impacts now 36.2 million Americans with just canned food drives, is like trying to fill the Grand Canyon with a teaspoon. Thank goodness there are some really progressive food banks around the country. And again, I'm not just sucking up because I'm in Oregon, but the Oregon Food Bank is one of the most progressive food banks in the country. They had the guts to come out for a minimum wage increase. They do a lot of things to support community food security. They understand it's not just about continuing to give out the same old charity food. But even with their amazing efforts, without government taking the lead, they're never going to be able to end the problem.
You say it's essential for government to take the lead.
Absolutely. People say to me, Joel, why are you so pro-government? Why don't you have community solve the problem? And I remind people that in democracy, government should be the embodiment of community. I have a chart in my book where I point out that if we entirely double the charitable food distribution system in America, which now spends about $2 billion a year on food, we barely dent the hunger problem. But if we increase the federal nutrition assistance safety net by only 41%, and that safety net's about $65 billion a year now, we can entirely end hunger in America. So I'll leave it up to your listeners. Would you rather just dent the problem by feeling good about another canned food drive, or do you really want to end the problem? And I've also calculated that we could end the problem for $24 billion a year, but it costs our economy to have hunger $90 billion a year because hungry children learn less well, hungry workers work less productively, hungry people cost our society far more in health care. So if someone came to you and said, a handy person, and said, there's a leak in your roof, and it costs you $90 a year in extra spending on utilities for heat and cooling, and we could fix it for $24, wouldn't you do it? Well, that's the situation we face in hunger. Of course we should fix the problem for $24 billion if it costs us $90 billion.
Again, tonight, Joel Berg, All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? He's going to be at Powell Cities of Books at 7:30 p.m. He's going to talk about his book, All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, on Seven Stories Press. Joel, you mention Oregon a lot as a standout. We do have our, I don't think it's mentioned in the book, but we do have now the ability to use the SNAP cards, the supplemental cards, the food stamp cards, I guess we'll say the Oregon Trail cards, at farmers markets.
Yes.
Is this something that's taking off around the nation?
It is. You know, over the last few decades, food stamps moved away from being a paper coupon to being a card similar to an ATM card or a credit card. It was a very positive advance. Advocates like myself loved it because it reduced stigma. Even conservatives loved it because it did reduce fraud. The only problem with it was that at farmers markets around the country, it dramatically reduced the use of food stamps benefits because to use these cards, you needed both electricity and a phone connection. So places like Oregon have been in the lead in this. We've been making a lot of progress in New York City on this. We helped farmers get handheld wireless devices that can accept these benefits. And I must say, even some, you know, people who think of themselves as liberals and nutritionists say, oh, low-income people are just too ignorant and uneducated to know that they need fresh produce. That's poppycock. I can say poppycock on the radio, I think.
So
yeah,
far,
in New York City,
so far.
Yeah, and so far, line. Right, until the FCC bans that.
Right.
Well, I know the word poppy is dangerous. Anyway, in New York City, the number of the food stamps redemptions at farmers markets have increased threefold in the first few years that these markets have accepted these benefits. So I know that low-income people, like everyone else, desperately want the freshest produce, the best food for their families, and when they have the economic capacity and the physical ability to get this food, they will definitely get it and serve it to their families.
Right now, a lot of poor people can't get to the farmers markets, can't get the fresh produce because it's not in their neighborhood. The lack of supermarkets, you say, makes a concrete difference. Areas without a full range of markets are obesogenic.
Yeah, I love that word.
Obesity producing. So that's one of the far right's of big arguments against hunger in America that we're an obese society. What about that, Joel?
I have a whole chapter in my book called Is America Fat or Is It Hungry? And I basically document in very clear detail, but fun detail again, that hunger and obesity are actually flip sides of the same malnutrition coin. That when you are poor and can't afford the most nutritious food that's the least fattening food, you have to buy the least nutritious food that's the cheapest that fills your belly. Not only that, low-income people, again, are less likely to have food stores in their neighborhood that have fresh produce. Even in the Pacific Northwest that produces such great produce, it's in a ridiculous irony that many low-income neighborhoods, and not just in the cities and rural areas, don't have this stuff, even if they grow it nearby. And lastly, low-income people are less likely to have a public park nearby that's safe to exercise in. They're less likely to have a gym nearby or afford a gym membership. So being poor definitely adds to the obesity rate. And I challenge not only the conservatives who deny the problem, but also sort of some of my friends who are foodies who sort of focus only on the availability of pristine greens in sort of yuppie boutique, you know, programs or their nice, you know, farmers market in the yuppie neighborhood. I say we've got to be concerned about small farmers. We've got to be concerned about organic food, but we've got to make it more economically affordable, and we've got to make it available not just in the yuppie neighborhoods, but in every neighborhood of America.
Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. Your book is fascinating. There's so much I wish we could go into, but half an hour just isn't enough time. One of the chapters, Chapter 7, Dickens Revisited, Life in the New Gilded Age, where it starts out with a quote from Michael Bloomberg, New York City mayor: some things people can afford, some things people can't. And also former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney: if there wasn't enough reasons to dislike the man, here we are. Sometimes I get frustrated when I hear politicians say there are two Americas. I don't believe there are two Americas. There's a model of thought among Democrats that the amount of money, the amount of wealth in a nation is a fixed amount, and that if Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are making a lot of money, that just means somebody else is not able to make as much. That happens to be entirely false. Is that entirely false, Joel?
No, it is not, and it's fairly easy for Mitt Romney to say as a millionaire, there are definitely two Americas.
Millionaire, there's... you mean 350 millionaire. He had $350 million.
Yeah, that's nothing. Last year, there were so many billionaires in America that merely having $1 billion wasn't enough to get you on the Forbes 400 list. And I don't begrudge billionaires their money, but I point out in the book this sort of myth we've developed that they earned it all on their own is preposterous. They are supported by government roads they ship their goods over. Internet billionaires are sometimes the most anti-government folks around. And while Al Gore didn't personally invent the Internet, people tend to forget the Internet was invented by government. Even, you know, educated workforces like a Microsoft workforce, many of the folks there went to public schools, public universities. Facilities are protected by government firefighters and government police officers. This myth in America that anyone is entirely self-made is really preposterous. And the good news is, even people like Warren Buffett say that's preposterous. He points out he went to a public university. He points out his personal success owes a lot to society. So I don't begrudge billionaires their billions. I just wish they were once again paying even close to their fair share of taxes. This claim that Obama's budget proposals are making us a socialist nation is just laughable. His budget proposals, his taxation proposals, would merely move tax levels for the ultra-rich to lower levels than they were in the Reagan era. We're not redistributing the wealth. We're just marginally reclaiming some of the wealth we've already given away to the richest in our society. And I think that just makes sense. I'm actually a committed capitalist. You know, my grandparents came here and built a better life for themselves and their grandchildren for hard work. But that's not how people are getting ahead today. It's basically based on who they know, and it's crony capitalism that's replaced opportunity capitalism. So I believe in opportunity capitalism with a safety net for those who can't make it, and that's what we need to do in America, and if we do that, we can end hunger.
You outline the specifics of this in the final chapters of your book. Again, All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, and you will be speaking tonight at Powell's on Burnside at 7:30. I also have some numbers I'd like to give folks out that they're experiencing hunger right now. And there's some phone numbers. This is the Oregon State Information Hotline number. It's 1-800-723-3638. And if you're in the Portland area, that's 503-988-5888. If you go online, you can go to OregonHelps.org. That's one word, OregonHelps.org. We have an organization in town, Food Not Bombs, and if you go to the Portland India Media website, they will give you the where they're going to be serving in town. Lots of emergency hunger relief organizations here in town. We have also the Oregon State University Extension Family and Community. That's www.extension.oregonstate.edu. And I don't expect everybody to write all these things down. I'm going to have all these things up at the front desk for those people who want to call our front desk who don't have access to computers. I found that if you write in SNAP, that will take you someplace. Oregon SafeNet is another place. And in Salem, the number is for information there for the Salem-Keizer School Kaiser School District is 503-399-3151. And the difference between, we don't have time to get into it, but Joel, you'll be in town tonight again at Powell's. That's Powell's City Books on Burnside at 7:30. The book is All You Can Eat, How Hungry is America? And it's out by, Seven Stories Press. And you thank them and your mother, Belle, and your father, Bernard, who gave your mind a hunger for learning. And Joel, we look forward to seeing you tonight in Portland, and thanks for writing the book.
Okay, thank you so much for your time and your interest in this issue.
And we're going to continue on. This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation's annual Justice Within Reach benefit event, Saturday, April 4th at Pear. The event celebrates stories of hope and justice from around the state. The party featured DJ Adiva, a.k.a. KBOO Celeste Carey, in the MRG Foundation/KBOO Community Story Booth, where guests can record their own stories of hope and justice. That's the MRG Foundation's Justice Within Reach benefit Saturday, April 4th, at Pear, downtown Portland at Northwest 6th and Flanders. More information, including guidelines for the story booth, available on the MRG Foundation website, www.mrgfoundation.org. KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation's annual Justice Within Reach benefit event, Saturday, April 4th at Pear. The event celebrates stories of hope and justice from around the state. The party featured DJ Adiva, a.k.a. KBOO Celeste Carey, in the MRG Foundation/KBOO Community Story Booth, where guests can record their own stories of hope and justice. That's the MRG Foundation's Justice Within Reach benefit Saturday, April 4th, at Pear, downtown Portland at Northwest 6th and Flanders. More information, including guidelines for the story booth, available on the MRG Foundation website, www.mrgfoundation.org.
It's 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Tuesday Radio Zine on KBOO Portland 90.7. Still to come at 10:15 on Flashpoints, Greg Pallas talks about the anniversary of the Valdez spill and the economic meltdown. Also, a short interview with Malik Rahim of Common Ground Relief. At 11 on stage and studio, D-May Roberts welcomes guests from Northwest Children's Theater's production of Goodnight Moon. And producer Frank Reynolds talks to people around Portland about finding funding for the arts and the importance of culture in tough economic times. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews Vanessa Renwick about her new show at the New American Art Union. Renwick works in experimental and poetic documentary forms and produces films, videos, and installations that explore the possibility of hope in contemporary society. Up next, it's Air Cascadia News and Commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta.